Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
Center of gravity, base of support, working within the base of support, approaching the end of the base of support, end game representations of structural archetypes, end game not necessarily being the end.
What's the end of the base of support?
Yes, the end game within the base of support.
Like, it is the last moment of access to relative motions.
Yeah.
That's the end. Because that's right. Typically, like that's what we want people to be able to move their joints, right? Because that would be a representation of protection, efficiency from an energy standpoint, from connective tissue behavior access. I mean, it just makes your life that much easier in all respects to have access to early, middle, and late propulsion, right? That's where we would prefer to work and live, right? That gives us the best opportunities from a health standpoint.
Right. So we got...
Yeah. Performance, not necessarily, right?
Well, because a lot of athletic activities are happening outside the base of support. They have to.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I mean, the amount of force that's being produced, the changes of direction are, you know, think about how severe some of the changes of direction are and how quickly things need to happen. You know, like you can't do that with relative motion because relative motion is too slow. Like you just can't do it. Right. And this is one of the reasons why athletes have stuff like every great athlete is going to come in with like, I got this thingy, I got that thingy that interferes with their ability to perform, which is why we're always managing those things.
Right. The things that look the most wildly athletic are very far outside of the base of support. So gymnastics, I'm thinking about gymnastics. I'm thinking about javelin throwing, pole vaulting, high jumping, where you're in these very extreme representations in order to create the highest connective tissue response possible.
Yes.
Which requires orientation well outside of the base of support, locking tons of stuff together for an instant to allow this incredible release of energy, right?
Well, imagine take all the relative motions of your joints. So theoretically, there's 244 degrees of freedom in the entire body, right? Let's take 244 separate segments, jam them into one piece, and turn the body into one giant bendy thing that acts like a giant spring.
Yeah. You know,
like do a long jump, do a high jump, do a clean and jerk. Like all of those things, it's like the body is tying itself into as few segments as possible in that circumstance. And then the connective tissue behavior takes over and stores and releases as much of the energy that it can in many circumstances.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
So to sort of try to simplify the concept to get to where we're trying to go here, the stresses, internal and external forces, are pushing us forward to the right. Yep. We're ending up forward and to the right. On the extreme ends of structural archetypes, we have a narrow who's going to go forward on the left and then over to the right. And then we have a wide who's going to make an oblique turn over to the right, which will net them forward to the right, but they're not eventually going forward and to the right. Yeah. So they're still going forward to the right, but the way that they're getting there is different than
the center of gravity. The center of gravity is actually going to go towards the rear of the right foot and then go forward
instead of going forward on the left foot and then over to the right foot.
Correct. Okay. Because you're unweighting, you literally unweight the left side on their oblique turn. It takes weight away, so the center of gravity can't go in that direction. You're lifting
right.
You're literally lifting it up. It'd be like picking up your left foot.
Yeah, and so that what we call an end game presentation of somebody when you're measuring them on a table or you're doing some type of assessment of them, that's within that base of support. They are all the way on the front outside edge of that right foot. There's this hot marker of pressure on that spot. That is not necessarily the last step. So there are options. If I still want to,
can I give an analogy?
Yeah, please.
Okay. You're standing at the edge of a cliff that you don't want to fall off of. And there's a little man standing to your side, right? And he's giving you like a little nudge in the direction of falling over the cliff. That's endgame. Okay. The strategies after that point where it looks like you're going to tip over and go over the edge of the cliff, that's outside the basis because you would be falling in that direction. And now you're literally going to change the shape of your body to hold that last position. Yes.
So you're going to bend your spine. You're going to step your other leg. You're going to step your other leg over to try to stop it. You're going to pull the whole right side down, or you're going to pull the whole left side down and turn.
Yeah. Those pull downs are actually rather aggressive twists. Because you're literally trying to increase your density. You're trying to shorten your vertical dimension to hold a position. Somebody's trying to shove you over the cliff, and you're saying, "I'm not going to go. I'm going to resist. I'm going to do whatever I can." Your physical structure then determines what your options are in that situation. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think one of the tricky parts of that when it comes from a measuring perspective. Is I've exhausted the base of support. I've now superimposed these strategies to try to fight against that continued push forward towards that side to not fall over the cliff. Is that really the place where the measures start to get really dirty?
Well, all measures are dirty, period.
Yeah, right? but at this point, maybe the most confusing, I guess.
Okay.
I'm trying to like,
yeah. So here's what I tried to be as consistent with language as possible.
Right.
Because what I will say is I make reference to a measure, not the what the measure would represent in a situation of relative motion. So for instance, if you have somebody that is using a strategy that would take place outside of the base of support. So like literally if my feet are level, but I step across. So stand up, put your feet on the ground, take your left foot, step across your right foot. So there is a strategy that will measure as if you are doing that activity. Okay. That is not relative motion at that point. You've stepped outside the base of support, which means that you are bending and twisting tissues to create that shape. However, we would measure the same way that we would measure anybody else. Like if we're doing like a table test and I say, well, I'm measuring her early hip IR, that measure will actually increase in that circumstance, but it is not the relative motion of early IR that we would see had you been inside of the base of support. By looking at our combination of measures, so we would look at it, what we would refer to as our chessboard, which is all of our measures that we would take, we would be able to discern whether that measurement was taking place inside of the base of support or if it's a strategy that we would use had we gone outside the base of support. So when we're talking about the early IR measure, We would still take the same measure, but like I said, its frame of reference would be, oh, this is somebody that is actually using the strategy that is stepping across. Okay.
Right.
So we have to be careful how we state these things. Because it's hard enough and confusing enough. Right.
Right. So when it comes to the reverse engineering piece, so if I'm trying to bring someone back within their base of support and they are starting from a position that is outside of it, I have to address what strategy they're using outside of their base of support first. Correct. So what are the best ways to determine which outside of the base of support strategy someone is using?
Well, first and foremost, we have to say, okay, because there's a couple of options here. I can make the left side go faster. I can make both sides go faster, or I can bend stuff harder and harder and harder to stay down and inside. I will see alterations in bony structure to hold this position that will substitute for measures, right? That will increase certain measures.
So you would see that on an X-ray, you would see a femur that's shortened, or you would see, like, you could actually measure the bone changes. You would see.
Yeah, I believe I just recently sent you a 3D CT scan of somebody and doing a standing scan, and they have actually measured this. Like you will see the difference in, like, they will measure the length and they will measure the orientation as in degrees as to how much of a difference that there actually is between, like, say, two sides or whatever the representation would have been. Yeah.
But they got a short right leg though. So they need an orthotic.
Okay. So if I, here's,
that's me. That was sarcasm, by the way, everyone.
But this is one of the concerns that I have when people start to manipulate like heel lifts and things like that. They'll say, "Oh, you have a short leg," when the reality is like, okay, yes, I do have an ER to IR differential that is increased, which if by twisting anything, you shorten its relative length, right? So then they would say, "Oh, you have a short leg," rather than saying, "Why do you have a short leg?" Because we can actually influence these bony shape changes in a favorable way, and then the leg is no longer short. Right. But if I jam something up underneath the heel, I can actually make this worse because I have now put them in a situation where I might actually need to magnify the strategy further. And now I increase a greater differential. So you're actually making this whole scenario worse rather than saying, what is the source of this deficit? And where can I influence this deficit? And again, we can do this by identifying what strategy that they're actually using, whether it be inside or outside the base of support.
Right. I mean, I guess I'm just looking for where to start.
Okay. Okay. So there'll be certain measures that will get magnified that should not exist. So for instance, if you're as far forward inside of the base of support as possible, you have no access to relative motion internal rotation. So you provide a substitution for that, which is an anti-orientation. So an anti-orientation, if we just talk about like the pelvis as an entity, the pelvis will continue to anteriorly orient as you lose relative motion internal rotation, because that is the substitution, because the internal rotation is what holds you down. Okay. If I anteriorly orient the pelvis, I am pushing down. There's my substitution. Awesome. If I go outside the base of support, what we see is a return of the early internal rotation measurement. That should not exist. So I started with zeros. I do a step over strategy, which would typically take me outside the base of support. And what I see is a return of that internal rotation. So this is one of the things that we would identify in our chessboard. Okay.
Okay. So this would be, if we have an anterior, so the anterior orientation is giving the early ER or early IR, like a
it's
false
a substitution.
Tell.
Yeah. It's a substitution which does not show up as an early internal rotation measurement until you go outside of the base of support.
But so what would be indicative of this to me would be like a very, very, very limited straight leg raise, but they also somehow have early IR. That would mean that I have an anti orientation
and somebody that stepped outside
and
of
then
the base
someone
of
that's
support.
Stepped over.
Yes.
So they can't,
that is correct.
They have like a 10, they can, their straight leg raise is like 15 degrees. And then they have somehow they have early IR.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. 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 For sure.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So here's the reasoning. Here's the reasoning.
Yeah.
So I start, like, this is my 2 feet on the ground. This is me standing with my 2 feet on the ground. And so there's the strategy that this person is using. Right.
Yes.
And everybody would go, well, just grab that foot and step back over. Awesome. But here's the problem. Where's forward?
Now it's facing
forward's
the side.
Over here.
Yeah.
So here's the problem. If forward is now over here. Okay. So I
step over. Bill is pointing to the right. His left foot has stepped over the right.
I always forget.
It's one of those. So yeah, we just talked to Joel Smith and he was like, yeah, sometimes, because a lot of people still love to listen to podcasts. And ours is, we don't really, it's like, just go watch it on YouTube.
Please come to the YouTube. Please come to the YouTube channel and watch the video so you can see what I'm doing. All right. So here we go. Bill's holding up both hands. He's crossing one hand over. There you go.
His left hand over his right hand.
Yeah. So if I did that step over strategy, forward would actually be way over to the right.
To the right.
Okay. Because again, it's like forward is now going, it's leading me outside of the base of support. So, but here's the problem. If I pull this foot back, I'm not reestablishing the base of support. What I'm actually doing is I'm planting my left foot and forward is still going in that direction. So what I did is I shoved myself harder into the strategy. Oops, big mistake. It doesn't work that way. So if I do this, what I need to do, so think about this. Let's take the base of support that we had that we thought was going in what we perceive as the forward direction, and let's reorient the base of support in the forward direction. So what I actually need to do is I need to take my right foot, I need to bring it back around this way, plant it into the ground here, and now I've actually arrested this rightward turn. I've anchored my foot into the ground, and I've come to a stop. So the turn that was creating this change in the forward direction has now stopped. That's the viable strategy. And this is a very, very common error. People will try to bring this left foot back to what they perceive as forward. It's not the real forward. And then what they end up with is they get magnified ER measures. And they go, wow, I did this great job of bringing back this early ER representation. And what they actually measured was the thoracic spine rolling on the table. Mistake number one. Right? It's like not understanding where your measures are actually coming from. Right? So think about this. Instead of trying to bring the foot back, take the base of support to the feet. Right? So I'm actually going to move my base of support. Well, what does this look like? So if I stepped over like this and I go like that, well, what does that look like? That looks like I'm laying on my right side. Brilliant strategy. That's why
laying on the right side. Right. And then progressing to learning how to roll from right to left.
I got it. Yeah. Because the cool thing about it is the ground then provides me an element of stopping the turn.
Yeah.
Right. Then all I have to do is secure a ground contact over on that right side. Could be a foot, could be a hip, could be a knee, could be a shoulder, could be an elbow, could be a hand. It all depends on what we actually have access to as ground contacts. But this is why we talk about using right side lying activity so much, is because it arrests all of this strategy that keeps turning us into this right side and changing the direction of forward.
Yeah. So put your hands up again. I want to try to talk about
for those of you listening, Bill is now putting his hands back up.
So when Bill steps over and you're talking about like repositioning to kind of meet where you are, it doesn't, the way that you're putting your hands out, it is not a purely right side lying position. And you might not be able, if you have enough ER orientation, getting into like true right side lying might not be the first step.
Correct.
They might need to be in more of like a three quarters side lying position.
Absolutely.
And you having your hands there was more indicative of that.
So that's a three quarter
position. Yeah. So that is not side lying would be full on.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So hang on. So this gets better. This gets so much better. Okay. So I do this. So I do this strategy, right? Okay. But if I step in that direction, if I step more in that direction, okay. Now forward is going there, so it's much easier for me to bring this foot into this space, and I can turn this into a square side lying position. Or if I step really far and the spine's turning really fast, boom, it's going to land me right on my side.
So
it's still useful. Still useful. Like again, true side lying. I don't want to negate true side lying because we use it so much, because we get a lot of people that are using these really, really strong turning strategies.
Yeah. The reason I brought that up was so that to bring to people's attention that, oh, well, I just start everyone in right side lying. And then the question that I usually will bring up is, are they ready to do that? Have they shown you that they can actually get into that position? If they can't, if they don't, they can't acquire that sort of IR shape of the right pelvis and the right side of the body, they're not really going to be able to. So that's what's useful with those intermediary transitional type of movements that Bill's describing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Or you might require manual intervention where I'm going to reshape your right side for you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Which can provide the same type.
That's what those techniques have always been for is when somebody can't acquire their own inputs to control positions in space and reacquire motion. It's like, that's why we use our hands. The hands become the leading resistances or the sensory inputs that influence the nervous system to change motor output, which allows us to take tension off of bony structure, which allows the bony structure to then change shape, and so on and so forth.
Okay, so let's say that's our four instance for someone who has stepped over outside. We're still talking about outside the base of support. We're talking about getting back within the base of support to start to reverse engineer it. Uh-huh. This last, for instance, example was someone who has stepped their left foot over their right. Uh-huh. And that was indicated by a limited, in this scenario, was limited straight leg raise with early IR measure, with a fake, or if someone has early IR available and they have like a 10 degree straight leg raise, that doesn't add up. And that would be indicative of this sort of stepped over.
It would certainly be an influence. The thing that I would look at would be like early IR, late ER.
Okay.
And then so you have an early ER deficit, you have a magnified early IR and a magnified late ER.
Okay.
Those would be the big ones.
The magnified late ER is because of that. When you step over, if you actually were to stand up and take a big step over with the left, that orientation that you're going to be kind of on the outsides of your feet, that is like a late, that is fake late ER, basically.
So you have to look at the shape of the spine. The shape of the spine is what contributes. So you're no longer measuring a hip, an innominate, a sacrum, and a spine. You're just measuring. You've literally compressed the spine into one piece. You've bent it to such a degree that now, like because of the directions that you're actually measuring when you're measuring late ER and early IR, the spine turns away in both circumstances. So both of those measures get magnified.
Yeah.
Okay. And again, this is just recognizing the shape change that's associated with the loss of relative motions. People make the assumption that they're always measuring relative movement, that people are always starting from this magically dirty word, neutral position. And that is not the reality.
Well, especially they go, oh, I have you on a table. You're in anatomical neutral position to start. It's like, no.
Yeah.
No. Okay. So
this is why interpretation of the chessboard becomes so important, because it allows you to recognize these things. And then your interventions are infinitely more targeted and infinitely more effective.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I want to continue with this for like a couple other examples, but I just wanted to take an opportunity to, if anyone is listening to this that isn't really into this stuff and is like not a new HP plus, I apologize. Like, you're a real trooper if you're sticking this out, because we're talking about this podcast was originally devised to be something for general population people, but it is this episode is far from that.
It's impossible to have this conversation.
Absolutely.
Because these concepts are not they're not traditionally viewed this way.
Yeah. So we talked about the step over. What would be I wanted to get into socket orientation, and I want to get into the spine turning ahead of the acetabulum. Are those the main ones?
We've already talked about that. We've already talked about that on one side.
So the other side, then.
If I step over with my left foot, I'm going to see these magnified measures on the left side. If I turn fast enough, okay? So again, just because of physical structures, people will have elements of rotation that will occur at a much higher rate. The spine will still move in front of the acetabulum on both sides, and then I will see magnified measures in both circumstances. So I will see IRs that I should not have on the right side. I will have late ERs that I should not see, and they will show up on the right side. Okay. And that's just a rate of turning. That's all that means, because I can have one side that turns faster than the other, which is a really tough thing to perceive.
Yeah.
But it is the reality. It's like somebody anchoring their right foot into the ground and stepping over with their left foot means that the left side's coming around, the right side's holding position. Okay. Yeah. If I turn fast enough, both sides will turn. So the left side's turning faster, the right side's turning faster. I'll see the magnified early IRs, late ERs, like I just talked about. I'll see that on both sides. But think about this. So I have this stud that's going to hold on to this right side position. Okay. no matter what. Left side's still pushing, trying to make this right, aggressive right turn. But if I have enough time and I can hold enough downforce into the ground on the right side, I will start to bend very stiff tissues. And so we'll make reference to the pelvis here. So these are pelvic torsions. The way that you get torsion, like we talk about torsions a lot in like the cranium and stuff, because the dental community talks about those. But like torsions in the pelvis itself will start to reorient the acetabulum. And this will magnify certain measures. And so this is one of those ways that we'll see like a magnification of early ER that we typically wouldn't see. And this is associated with literally a twist within the pelvis, but it's associated with the ability to maintain a measure of downforce as they're making this hard turn. So they have an anchor into the ground. One side's pushing really, really hard. And the right side just says, I'm not going to move. And then you have a tissue adaptation. And that's what we talk about when we talk about socket orientations.
So by orienting the socket, that allows me space to acquire, relatively speaking, some better IR at the proximal femur because I've created ER.
The IR is actually the downforce. So it's not going to be accessible by measurement. What's going to change is the ER measurement, because the socket's turning away from midline.
Because you're measuring joint position.
Right. Because with an anti-orientation, I should see a deficit of early ER, but I don't. But it's not relative motion because I don't see the increase in early IR that would go with it. So what I end up seeing is I'll still see a zero for early IR or a deficit, like a minus 10 IR, which means that you're starting from ER, you try to turn into IR, and I can't even get it to the imaginary zero point that you would typically see in a table test. So I have such a magnification of ER in this circumstance. This is a bony adaptation that turns a hip socket away from midline, magnifies the early IR measure, steals or prevents the early IR from being recognized that you would typically see.
Okay, so examples that I had used, I know you had used late ER and I didn't, but we could still use my example of limited straight leg raise to indicate an anterior orientation, no early IR, but exaggerated right early ER.
Yes.
And then what's happening with late ER is still magnified in that instance?
No, it will not be magnified in this instance because I can't think about it. I'm standing on my right leg.
If I had
late ER available to me, I would lose my balance.
Yeah, you would fall. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that I sort of answered as I was asking it.
And there you go.
Okay. So we talked about the left side moving too fast. We talked about the right side moving fast as well, causing pelvic torsion.
Yep.
What were the pulling down on the right and pulling down on the left?
So those have occurred as this process is taking place. So for every twist, there's going to be, this is all connective tissue behavior. We're outside. Like we've got to the end of the base of support, and then every strategy after that is associated with me trying to hold my position, right?
Okay.
Lowering your center of gravity is going to be part of that. Okay. Now, I wouldn't necessarily lose vertical dimension until I start to use an airflow strategy. Okay. And this is where we'll see like the pull down on the right for a narrow or the pull down on the left for a wide. And we're talking about archetypical structures now. So we have a wide helical archetype, we have a narrow helical archetype. They both get to the same place in the base of support. They get there in different directions, and therefore they have to use different strategies when they're trying to stay inside of the base of support. Yeah, but that's an airflow strategy that you would see that would be associated with the twisting that we were talking about with the connective tissue behaviors. So they're going to be part of this as far as. Like when you're trying to resolve these situations, Number one, you've got to eliminate the twisting connective tissue behavior. Then you have to restore the airflow issue, and that's what's going to bring you back inside the base of support. Because when you get to the late representation, you still have air in the thorax, right?
Okay.
And so, like a pull down strategy is a twisting motion that takes, like, again, there's no more propulsion at this point. Simply because we're using all connective tissue behaviors. And like I said, we've taken the air out of the thorax, which allows you to, it is a strategy to push down. It's an IR strategy, right? Doesn't magnify the IR measure.
Is the airflow strategy typically last as like the last final attempt?
It's part of the process itself.
I know it's all happening at the same time. But yeah. Is that the last little bit that I can squeeze out of it would be the airflow strategy right at the
end? Well, for me to twist harder, I would have to exhale.
Yeah. So, okay.
Case in point. Seated rotation test.
Yes.
Okay. So a seated rotation test starts at literally, I'm in a situation where I have minimized the amount of relative motion that's available. It's like a very connective tissue-y behavior test. So as I twist myself in a seated position, you can hear the airflow strategy in most people, because what they'll try to do is they will try to hold their breath, which is an exhalation strategy against the closed glottis, right? Well, if I open the glottis, I can actually turn farther. That's what people don't realize. So they go, they think I can twist harder, and they go, ah, when they come out of it, right? Then they have this expulsion of air. What you don't realize is that if I twist myself as far as I can, and then I exhale, I actually twist farther in the direction that I'm trying to twist. That's the actual strategy that people will use. And this is why we call it, we make reference to a pull down. Where you would see this show up in traditional literature, for those of the people that like to call BS on things, when you get a down slip or an up slip in the pelvis, these are actually the archetypical strategies that, so these things have been recognized, but they haven't been recognized for what they actually are. Okay. So like a down slip would be a strategy for a narrow ISA to try to hold themselves inside the base of support, but it's also the loss of vertical dimension. It's a breathing problem, right? It's an exhalation strategy to try to hold position. When you see the upslip, that's actually a strategy that a wide ISA uses in their first move. When they shift their base of support to the right heel, they actually create an upslip in the pelvis itself. And so they're not like a down slip is not an up slip on the other side. They are two different worlds. They're two different strategies. So hopefully I didn't make a mistake here and confuse everybody, but I just wanted to clarify what we're talking about.
The confusion we're talking about here is all your fault anyways. So we're just kind of like, we're just rolling with it. all I'm trying to do is like have this conversation to see if we can figure out a way to simplify it if possible.
Well, I'd have to learn something.
I have a couple ideas, but okay. can we if the seated rotation test is with very little relative motion available, use that as my identifying assessment for what outside the base of support strategy someone is using?
It will correlate with it, but it might not be the determining factor, because again, so think about this. It's like I will already have relative motions that are in deficit that will influence the seated rotation test. So if I've already identified someone as being using a strategy that would take them outside of the base of support,
right,
that test would correlate with that
strategy. That's more my question as a confirmation assessment.
Yes. Now here's the cool thing. It can now become a KPI, because if I see a recapture of the ability to turn to the left in the seated rotation test, it's highly likely that I've actually recovered a significant element of the base of support.
So I have taken my step over back to where
To a measurable degree. You can't say that you've fully recovered it per se, but you can say that I did something favorable.
Right. I've taken someone who has turned to the right and I've turned them back towards center a bit more.
No, you've moved the base of support over there. Let's not create that confusion. You didn't pull them back in. You just moved the base of support over and then turned them back to front. Okay. I know, crazy confusion. I don't want to encourage people to try to pull people back to the left. That's an error. It's an error in strategy. It's like I moved the base of support to them, and now they have a leftward turn versus a block that prevents the leftward turn. Okay. This is a really useful test. When you think about like a seated rotation and standing rotation test, the seated rotation test will help you, again, a before and an after. You need a comparative. You can't just use it blindly. I have to have done the test before the intervention. I have to do the test after the intervention to know that I did something favorable, okay? Once I'm inside the base of support, standing rotation becomes a very useful test in that circumstance because a standing rotation test is a base of support test because it has relative motions in it. Okay.
So I've identified that this person's outside their base of support with the measurements that we had talked about already. Yes. I'm using my measures and the seated rotation as sort of an indication of what progress I'm making. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then once my measures show me relative motions and I'm within my base of support, my standing rotation will help confirm. Okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Gotcha. Yeah. So again,
it's like most people will use these tests as comparators, which is great.
Yeah.
Okay. But we've refined the perception of what is actually happening during these tests. And so now you know when they're most useful. It's like if I'm just trying to bring somebody back inside the base of support and I know they were outside, it's like seated rotation first. There's your first comparator, right? Once I'm inside the base of support and I'm moving people around and I'm trying to recapture relative motions, standing rotation is a much more effective test than the seated rotation test because, again, seated rotation is very connective tissue-y.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, and the – well, full transparency, I'm probably not going to use any of these tests. I'm speaking as if I would be doing all these tests, but I don't.
But because you think about this for a second, though, it's like because you work virtually, then the value of these tests start to increase. Again, people use them all the time. People use all sorts of screening tools all the time, but they don't know why or when to use them. It's like there are very opportune times where the value of a test becomes much more useful and gives you much more information. That's what we're talking about now.
Yeah. Okay. So the outside of the base of support strategies, is it possible to simplify it into rightward turning strategies or leftward turning strategies and have that be two categories?
I'm not sure what you mean by a leftward turning strategy.
So if we were going to say that to fully exhaust the downforce based on structural archetype, I'm either going to have someone being pulled down, exhaling airflow, pulled down on the right, shortening everything, making higher density right side or higher density left side. Exhale, pulling down into the left. Could I then say that my two categories of strategies outside the base of support would be a rightward turn or a leftward turn?
No.
Okay.
They're all rightward turns. They're all rightward turns. Okay.
Okay.
Here's why. Narrow ISA bias is ER, which means that they will continue to add ER in the direction. So I would never produce a leftward strategy because that would immediately cause a loss of balance.
Yeah, because it would fall.
I would fall because of the leftward internal dynamic bias. It would knock me off my feet. So I would never use that strategy, which means that I need to continue to make a rightward turn. So here's how this happens. So because a narrow SI has an ER bias, so if I twist something, so this is important too, this is not relative to motion. If I twist something to the right, I have increased the compressive strategy that would be associated with that, which is actually a downforce. So what the narrow does is it increases ER to the right and that creates more IR downforce. Perfect. Problem solved. I'm lower. My center of gravity is lower. I'm pushing into the ground. I'm holding my position with IR. Narrow ISAs, because of the unweighting strategy that they used, and they start turning to the right, they add more IR on the left-hand side, which increases the ER on the right-hand side, because they're using a left-sided strategy, but they're over on the right side. So they pull down on the left, adding IR here. That creates the rightward turn twist again. So both of them are trying to resolve this with a rightward twisting activity. They just have to add different things because of their structural biases.
Okay. But it doesn't, it's not, there isn't necessarily a order of operations though. So it's not like a, you always step over and then you always get a socket orientation and then you always pull down.
No.
Okay.
Because it's rate dependent. It's like, it's so, you know, if you were to look at, okay, this is where the configurations can actually help you a little bit.
Okay.
To kind of see some of these things, because it's, again, it's like all we're doing is talking about structural constraints and behaviors. Yeah. Because the constraints determine what is possible and what will happen. So I will give you the most common representation.
Yes. Now,
I say this out loud and people are going to make these assumptions and they're going to immediately like try to make these calls on people, and it doesn't happen that way. But if right. we had to bet cash money on like somebody that would have a right socket orientation, it would be a wide ISA pylon. Mm-hmm. Because they spend more time in IR, so the downforce gives them a greater likelihood of having a right socket orientation, and the outlet of the pelvis turns faster than the inlet, which means that the right socket would turn faster in that circumstance. So they're more likely to have a right socket orientation because they have the IR, and they have a rate dependent ER that would turn the pelvis faster. So, they get the ER dimension and then the IR superimposed on
it. So you're talking about pressure differentials affecting the rate, and that is going to determine the strategy of what happens outside the base of support.
It's a hub and wheel scenario. Okay.
Yes.
So if I take a wheel and I spin the wheel, it appears that the whole wheel turns at the same rate, but because the distance on the outside of the wheel is greater, the outside of the wheel is actually turning at a higher velocity. And so if I have a pylon configuration of a pelvis, that means that the inlet turns slower than the outlet. Well, the acetabulum is approximated closer to the outlet. Therefore, the acetabulum turns faster than the inlet does. And therefore, this right socket orientation is more likely result, because I still have the IR element. I still have an increase in downforce because of configuration, but the configuration also determines that I would turn towards ER faster.
Okay. Or you could also, any sort of task or environment that required a high rate of force.
Oh yeah.
Also lead any configuration to a soccer.
A right foot high jumper is more likely
to have a
socket orientation than a bilateral orientation that we would see for a spine that's turning faster.
Sure.
In fact, you think about it because of the way that they would clear the bar, I would argue that it would be one of the greatest concerns that you would have for a right-footed high jumper, because the left spine has to turn faster than the right spine. And because of the planting of the IR into the right foot, it would be very, very common to see this.
Are there like
and what we see with right-foot high jumpers? We see a lot of hip pain associated.
Are you going to see a lot of crazy bony adaptation in the foot and ankle with a guy like that or a girl like that?
Oh yeah,
just because of that weird cranked position they have into.
Oh, you'll see all sorts of cool like you're going to see a thickening of the calcaneus. You'll see a thickening and a twist. You'll see a thickening and twisting of the Achilles. You're going to see a bigger differential in the femur, and then you're going to see the socket orientation. But again, because of the spine position and because of the socket orientation, there is a window where that would actually improve their performance, and then they cross outside of this threshold, and then it becomes interference where they can't where they can't shape change enough on the right side that they can store and release energy, they start dampening. And so then they start to see their jumps start to decrease. You'll see the same thing with a right foot long jumper. They'll have a period in their career where it's just ridiculously good, and then they will see a precipitous drop off at a certain point because of the changes in the plant leg. They get favorable changes that enhance performance, and then that same change taken to the next nth of degree becomes interference.
Okay. So, and I would also assume that your pylon configurations are going to be more likely to try to drive the top down airflow strategy.
It's easier
for them. So you'll see a pylon will have an easier time to pull down from airflow.
They already are, if you think about it, just by physical structure. Like they've already got the pressure gradient built in, which is why I always make the joke. It's like that's why they're the accountants and they're not the best vertical jumpers, right? Because all of their biases point them into the ground. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And then I'm also thinking about the likelihood of the step over. Is it going to be more predominant in like a narrow funnel?
Narrow funnel. Absolutely.
Yeah. Because they're teetering on that edge and they have to kind of fall and catch themselves.
Yeah. Well, now you think about the hub and wheel frame of reference. It's like the most superior aspect of them is turning faster, and that's going to drag them hard and fast around in a circle, right?
Yeah. So my attempt with this episode was to like take all of these things that I see are being confused and maybe try to give some examples of, because otherwise it seems too nebulous of a concept of like getting outside the base of support, but it's not. There are tendencies and behaviors that you can look for that will lead you in the right direction.
It's a tough thing to grasp because people aren't like dropping over and cracking their skulls on the ground. But what we're talking about is the strategies that you have to use are the same ones that you would use had someone tried to shove you outside of the base of support. You have to literally change the shape and density of your body to prevent the fall. Therefore, you are using a strategy that is outside the base of support. That's the explanation, right?
Okay. All right. I don't want to talk about this anymore. We didn't even really talk about like strategies to reverse engineer. We kind of did.
We don't have time, man. This is all a double episode. This is
yeah,
like a two-fold.
Maybe. I'll just put it out as one. I don't want to drag this out over 4 weeks of as it is, but who knows? Maybe this would be our most popular episode ever. All right. So, anyone still listening, congratulations to you. I hope that my like ramblings and questions to Bill helped people understand a little bit better. It helped me kind of understand a couple of things.
Well, here's the thing. It's like you can get on the network for free.
Yeah.
Right. And
you can listen to this podcast for free too.
Yeah. And this is just, if this is your first exposure and you're going like, what the hell is this?
What the hell is happening?
It's okay. Yeah. It's okay. These are things that have been misunderstood, I think. Right.
Absolutely.
Because people make these assumptions, like things like x-rays that show separate bones, and people say, but look, the bones are still separate. It's like, but they're not behaving separately. It's like once you start to link things together and they start to behave a certain way, it's like you've taken away strategies that we would love to have them exist, but they don't.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, okay, explain a spondy to me, explain a disc herniation.
Explain
strains. And it's like, why do they occur? It's like, this is why those things occur.
Right. Even the x-ray example, it's like, why? Okay. If everyone's got a short right leg and for some reason there's this weird genetic predisposition that people have shorter femurs on the right side, like why would that happen? Like, is that just like a unlucky genetic thing? It's like, no, maybe it's because the bone is just twisted so much that it's a towel that is shortened.
Not to restart the discussion here. It's like we have to have explanations for things.
Yeah.
Right. And we're trying to provide a coherent understanding. And if you want more of this understanding, it's like sign up for the network. It's free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
the question. Okay. I got a good one. What were the what were the magazines that you had subscriptions to that like you always looked forward to getting? Were you a magazine guy? I had a phase.
Okay. So all right. Bodybuilding was
thing. Which right. ones? Which okay. ones were the
Okay. So I Flex. Lived in a very small Okay. So I lived in a very small town. Very small town. 3,000 people. 3,000 people. At the time, we had two grocery stores, but only one had a magazine rack. Mm-hmm. Okay, and they would get it was Muscle and Fitness. Okay, Muscle and Fitness, and then Flex Magazine.
Right? Yeah.
And so now I would go there. I would steal $3 from my mother's purse, and I would go, and I would like twice a month. You would go, and you would buy it, and every once in a while, like a Muscle Digest would show up, or Muscular Development would show up, which was out of York, PA, or you would get Muscle Mag International. The very first bodybuilding magazine I ever bought was Muscle Mag International. I can tell you that because I bought it at the Ben Franklin. The one time they had one issue, bought it. And, but anyway, so I ended up getting a subscription to, Muscle and Fitness and Flex at one point in time. That was my birthday. Those were my birthday gifts. Yeah. So I had those. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I had, Game Pro Magazine. It's one of my
Game
favorites.
Pro.
Yeah. It was like a video game publication.
Okay.
That and Nintendo Power was like the Nintendo version of video game magazine.
Uh-huh.
And then like Men's Health, I had a subscription to Maxim Magazine. I had a subscription to for
See,
a while.
See, that's we're showing our age differential.
Here Yeah.
Cause those magazines did not exist. Like the gaming magazine for like my age group would have been like a single page.
That yeah, it would have been like Miss Pac-Man.
No, it's like Pong going back and forth on the home Atari.
Yeah,
you know that's
we had an Atari. Yeah, that's
like, fancy. I had to go to the bowling alley. I had to go to the bowling alley to play like Centipede and Ms. Pac-Man and stuff like that. But I
love that though. The smell of like the smell of the smell of bowling shoes,
cigarettes.
Lane oil. a deep fryer that the oil hadn't been changed in 20 years.
It's on everything.
Just
it's
old like, carpet.
You could smoke at the where I grew up. So
yeah. Cool. All right. Bye.